File 62.
It may happen that in the course of its history, such a people will come into contact a second time, and even oftener, with the original founders of their culture, and may not even remember that distant association. Instinctively, the remnants of blood left from that old ruling race will be drawn towards this new phenomenon, and what had formerly been possible only under compulsion can now be successfully achieved in a voluntary way. A new cultural wave flows in and lasts until the blood of its standard-bearers becomes once again adulterated by intermixture with the originally conquered race. It will be the task of those who set themselves to the study of a universal history of civilization to investigate history from this point of view, instead of allowing themselves to be smothered under the mass of external data, as is only too often the case with our present historical science. This short sketch of the changes that take place among those races that are only the depositaries of a culture also furnishes a picture of the development and activity and the disappearance of those who are the true founders of culture on this earth, namely, the Aryans themselves. Just as in our daily life, the so-called man of genius needs a particular occasion, and sometimes indeed a special stimulus, to bring his genius to light, so too in the life of the peoples, the race that has genius in it needs the occasion and stimulus to bring that genius to expression. In the monotony and routine of everyday life, even persons of significance seem just like the others, and do not rise beyond the average level of their fellow men. But as soon as such men find themselves in a special situation which disconcerts and unbalances the others, the humble person of apparently common qualities reveals traits of genius, often to the amazement of those who have hitherto known him in the small things of everyday life. That is the reason why a prophet only seldom counts for something in his own country. War offers an excellent occasion for observing this phenomenon. In times of distress, when the others despair, apparently harmless boys suddenly spring up and become heroes, full of determination, undaunted in the presence of death, and manifesting wonderful powers of calm reflection under such circumstances. If such an hour of trial did not come, nobody would have thought that the soul of a hero lurked in the body of that beardless youth. A special impulse is almost always necessary to bring a man of genius into the foreground. The sledgehammer of fate which strikes down the one so easily finds the counter-impact of steel when it strikes the other. And after the common shell of everyday life is broken, the core that lay hidden in it is displayed to the eyes of an astonished world. This surrounding world then grows obstinate, and will not believe that what had seemed so like itself is really of that different quality so suddenly displayed. This is a process which is repeated probably every time a man of outstanding significance appears. Though an inventor, for example, does not establish his fame until the very day that he carries through his invention, it would be a mistake to believe that the creative genius did not come alive in him until that moment. From the very hour of his birth, the spark of genius is living within the man who has been endowed with a real creative faculty. True genius is an innate quality. It can never be the result of education or training. As I have stated already, this holds good not merely of the individual, but also of the race. Those peoples who manifest creative abilities in certain periods of their history have always been fundamentally creative. It belongs to their very nature, even though this fact may escape the eyes of the superficial observer. Here also recognition from outside is the only consequence of practical achievement. Since the rest of the world is incapable of recognizing genius as such, it can only see the visible manifestations of genius in the form of inventions, discoveries, buildings, painting, etc. But even here, a long time passes before recognition is given. Just as the individual person who has been endowed with the gift of genius, or at least talent of a very high order, cannot bring that endowment to realization until he comes under the urge of special circumstances, so in the life of the nations, the creative capacities and powers frequently have to wait until certain conditions stimulate them to action. The most obvious example of this truth is furnished by that race which has been, and still is, the standard-bearer of human progress. I mean the Aryan race. As soon as fate brings them face to face with special circumstances, their powers begin to develop progressively and to be manifested in tangible form. The characteristic cultures which they create under such circumstances are almost always conditioned by the soil, the climate, and the people they subjugate. The last factor, that of the character of the people, is the most decisive one. The more primitive the technical conditions under which the civilizing activity takes place, the more necessary is the existence of manual labor, which can be organized and employed so as to take the place of mechanical power. Had it not been possible for them to employ members of the inferior race which they conquered, the Aryans would never have been in a position to take the first steps on the road which led them to a later type of culture, just as, without the help of certain suitable animals which they were able to tame, they would never have come to the invention of mechanical power, which has subsequently enabled them to do without these beasts. The phrase, "The Moor has accomplished his function, so let him now depart," has, unfortunately, a profound application. For thousands of years, the horse has been the faithful servant of man, and has helped him to lay the foundations of human progress. But now, motor power has dispensed with the use of the horse. In a few years to come, the use of the horse will cease entirely. And yet without its collaboration, man could scarcely have come to the stage of development which he has now created. For the establishment of superior types of civilization, the members of inferior races formed one of the most essential prerequisites. They alone could supply the lack of mechanical means without which no progress is possible. It is certain that the first stages of human civilization were not based so much on the use of tame animals as on the employment of human beings, who were members of an inferior race. Only after subjugated races were employed as slaves was a similar fate allotted to animals, and not vice versa, as some people would have us believe. At first, It was the conquered enemy who had to draw the plough, and only afterwards did the ox and horse take his place. Nobody else but pulling pacifists can consider this fact as a sign of human degradation. Such people fail to recognize that this evolution had to take place in order that man might reach that degree of civilization which these apostles now exploit in an attempt to make the world pay attention to their rigmarole. The progress of mankind may be compared to the process of ascending an infinite ladder. One does not reach the higher level without first having climbed the lower rungs. The Aryan, therefore, had to take that road which his sense of reality pointed out to him, and not that which the modern pacifist dreams of. The path of reality is, however, difficult and hard to tread. Yet it is the only one which finally leads to the goal where the others envisage mankind in their dreams. But the real truth is that those dreamers help only to lead man away from his goal rather than towards it. It was not by mere chance that the first forms of civilization arose there where the Aryan came into contact with inferior races, subjugated them, and forced them to obey his command. The members of the inferior race became the first mechanical tools in the service of a growing civilization. Thereby the way was clearly indicated which the Aryan had to follow. As a conqueror, he subjugated inferior races and turned their physical powers into organized channels under his own leadership, forcing them to follow his will and purpose. By imposing on them a useful, though hard, manner of employing their powers, he not only spared the lives of those whom he had conquered, but probably made their lives easier than these had been in the former state of so-called freedom. While he ruthlessly maintained his position as their master, he not only remained master, but he also maintained an advanced civilization. For this depended exclusively on his inborn abilities, and therefore on the preservation of the Aryan race as such. As soon, however, as his subject began to rise and approach the level of their conqueror, a phase of which ascension was probably the use of his language, the barriers that had distinguished master from servant broke down. The Aryan neglected to maintain his own racial stock unmixed, and therewith lost the right to live in the paradise which he himself had created. He became submerged in the racial mixture, and gradually lost his cultural creativeness, until he finally grew, not only mentally, but also physically, more like the aborigines whom he had subjected, rather than his own ancestors. For some time he could continue to live on the capital of that culture which still remained, but a condition of fossilization soon set in, and he sank into oblivion. That is how cultures and empires decline and yield their places to new formations. The adulteration of the blood and racial deterioration conditioned thereby are the only causes that account for the decline of ancient civilizations. For it is never by war that nations are ruined, but by the loss of their powers of resistance, which are exclusively a characteristic of pure racial blood. In this world, everything that is not of sound racial stock is like chaff. Every historical event in the world is nothing more nor less than a manifestation of the instinct of racial self-preservation, whether for weal or woe.